Our state is one of the biggest exporters in the country. Today, as we kick off our week-long conversation about the new administration and what it means for Illinois' economy, we start with agriculture and trade.
Some of the main issues for the new administration and the new Congress that impacting Illinois farmers include the upcoming farm bill debate and certainly trade issues and how that will impact the farm economy.
That's Jonathan Kappas, a former USDA official who's now at the University of Illinois. We'll talk with him, farmers across the state, and Chicago Council on Global Affairs economist Phil Levy joins us to explain more about what changes in trade policy might mean. We'll hear about whether we're closer to a state budget in Springfield and...
A little bouncer slowly toward Bryant. He will glove it and throw to Rizzo. It's in time! And the Chicago Cubs win the World Series!
Remember that. Chicago baseball fans will be able to watch next season's biggest moments on their mobile devices. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. President Trump pledged during his campaign that on day one, he would rewrite U.S. trade policy, including agreements like NAFTA and the Trans-Pacific Partnership. And he's just made good on that promise. Less than 72 hours after he took the oath of office, he has just signed executive orders about signing a notice that will start withdrawal from the Trans-Pacific Partnership. He's also already convened a group of business leaders at the White House this morning for coffee and pastries. All this week on the 21st, we are going to be talking about the new administration and how it relates to Illinois and to our economy. Tomorrow, we're going to be looking at manufacturing. Wednesday, healthcare. Today, we start with agriculture and trade. Illinois is the fifth largest exporting state in the country. Much of that, of course, agriculture and agricultural products. You can join the conversation as well. We've been asking you on social media what you want to see in these first 100 days. You can join our conversation. You can tweet to 21STShow, or you can call us right now. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455. We wanted to start our conversation today with two Illinois farmers from the northern part of the state. Brian Duncan raises hogs and also grows corn on his 4,000-acre family farm in Polo in northwest Illinois. Paul Taylor has corn, soy, and specialty crops on 650 acres of his family farm. That's in Esmond in DeKalb County. Brian, Paul, welcome to the 21st. Good morning. Thanks for being with me.
Good morning, Nyla. Great to be here.
Paul, let's start with you. I wonder, what are you thinking about the new Trump administration? What do you want to see happen or not happen in Washington as a farmer?
Well, I think with any time there's an administration change, there's always concern about the things that perhaps we've liked and the upcoming uncertainty. Uncertainty is one of the things that's driving us now. I think one of the things that was talked about that concern is that whole area of trade in the conversation. NAFTA, TPP, Trans-Pacific Partnership, you mentioned, those have typically been very good for agriculture and especially good for Illinois as an exporting state. So trade is one of the issues that we're concerned about. There's some other things with what we might consider administrative overreach, EPA, Waters of the U.S., some other things like that, that we want to be careful and watch.
Mm-hmm. Brian, what about you? What issues are most important to you as a farmer?
Well, I think as we go forward, I'd echo what Paul said. And right now, it's a mixed bag for us, and I think we're all kind of in wait-and-see mode. The things that we're hopeful for is, like Paul said, some regulatory relief what we see some of the overreach, especially in the environmental areas, and some tax relief as well, pertaining as far as the estate tax. And a lot of calls that I've been getting lately on Farm Bureau president from my members has to do with health insurance and the cost that it is for independent businessmen. I mean, we've got a lot of people reporting they're paying over $20,000 a year in premiums for a policy with a $5,000 deductible. So we're hopeful on that end. And then, again, trade. We're very trade dependent, and so I'll be watching that very closely. And then we're going to be writing a new farm bill. That's on my radar as well, starting next year. And I think the process will probably even begin this year. But we need to have a new farm bill written in 2018. So those are issues we're looking at.
And Brian, when you talk about healthcare in particular, what would you like to see happen in terms of Obamacare? You said that you're hearing from folks who are calling you that this is it's too expensive. It's not something they can afford.
Yeah, we've got to get some sort of relief for private policies, and I don't know, what that looks like. In a lot of ways, the horse has left the barn, and so I don't know how this gets accomplished. I just know that paying over $20,000 a year for a policy that just 5 or 6 years ago cost $5,000 is many people are viewing that as unsustainable.
That's Farmer Brian Duncan. We're also speaking with Paul Taylor. Paul, I know that healthcare is also an important issue for you, also being someone who's self-employed. Have changes in Obamacare affected you personally and you and your family?
Well, I think Brian really hit on something there, and it's something we talked about a little bit beforehand. But the point is, my wife and I'm nearing 65, so I'm looking forward to Medicare like I was looking forward to being 16 and having my driver's license. Our costs in 2017 will be $2,200 a month as a couple with $6,000 each deductible. And we sat down about 4 years ago and just kind of did some expectations of, by the time my wife and I each reach 65, which will be the beginning of next year, that we expected we were going to have nearly $100,000 need for health care, both through insurance and in costs. And we're right on track, unfortunately. How do we fix it? I'm not sure. I just know that there's real issues. I think it's stymieing independent small farmers, folks that don't have opportunities to get insurance through perhaps a spouse's employment or off-farm employment or Medicare, whatever. It's just tough, and it's tough on the small business people in rural communities that try to run a machine shop, a painting business, other things, and have $20,000 a year of health care costs. The rub is, when we hear it on the radio, healthcare, it's good. There's discounts, there's rebates, you won't have to pay that. But there's a segment of us that make too much money, we have family expenses that exceed, we need to have the income, and we just don't qualify for those discounts, if you will. And so it's a huge hole in our budget. Healthcare is an issue. Rural America, independent business people, we need some attention to that, and I'm not sure.
Yeah, it's tough, right, Paul? I mean, what would you say to lawmakers? I'm thinking about the different folks from Congress who I've been talking to about health care in the past couple of weeks, in this past 2 weeks in particular, whether it's Sherry Bustos on the Democratic side, Ronnie Davis on the Republican side. We're hearing very different things. And to both of them, what would you say? Brian, I'd love to hear from you, too. But, Paul, can you start? How do you want things to be fixed? It sounds like you're saying we need to figure out a way to lower costs for self-employed.
Yeah, we have to figure out costs, exposure. I think part of it is our costs on the service end have just gotten so extremely high. Are those real costs? Are they costs that are up there to cover folks that still aren't insured, lower payments? I don't know. But the whole issue of I fully think that some of the things that are in Obamacare, maybe bringing the youth on, still under their parents' policy while they're in college. I know my wife and I both have pre-existing conditions. Those are big concerns if we have to change. I don't have the answer. I'm sorry. It's been going on for a long time. And I think it's everything from drug pharmacy costs to costs of services to liability insurance for our medical providers. I'm not sure, but there's
they're big issues. Sure, so that's why it's such a complex issue. I appreciate that. I wanted to bring someone else in this conversation too. We've been talking to farmers Paul Taylor and Brian Duncan in studio with me. Jonathan Copus is a former federal agricultural policy expert. Worked in the Senate and the USDA. He's now at the University of Illinois. Jonathan Copus, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Nyla. It's great to be here.
So we were just hearing Brian and Paul talk about a lot of issues, right? Healthcare, regulatory pressures, the farm bill that's probably going to start being written this year. That's something you actually worked on when you were in Washington. I know that it's difficult to predict right now these first 100 days, although we're already seeing in just this past couple of minutes movement on trade in particular. What do you think overall expectations are for the farming community here in Illinois from a policy standpoint? What do you think are going to be the biggest issues?
Well, I think certainly, trade is really going to rise up to the top and has been a big part of the conversation throughout this campaign. And then, you know, what does it mean now for farmers as we step back from the TPP and start looking at things like NAFTA, given the importance of export markets for farm commodities, corn and soybeans, you know, for this state, particularly soybeans. We've seen China and other countries really step up in a big way in the last 10, 15 years purchasing soybeans. And so what does that mean? And then obviously the farm bill I think, you know, both Paul and Brian, absolutely, we're going to start to see that discussion. I mean, we're already underway with the discussion with farmers at the local level to try to get feedback on the current bill, and then thinking through how the process is going to look, because there's pretty busy legislative calendar for Congress in the coming year. So trying to figure out how some of that's going to fit in is a big question.
I do want to get to trade in a minute, and we're going to have a bigger conversation about trade after the break as well. But can I ask, Jonathan, as someone who helped work on this and actually write the past farm bills, how much does a president get involved with that?
Well, USDA obviously is the lead from the executive branch. And what I was saying, we talked about this with farmers when we go through the listening sessions, and everybody's waiting for the Secretary of Ag to be announced who the nominee was going to be. That the farm bill is very much a congressional effort. It begins in the Ag committees. It's very localized. So, you know, who are the members of the Ag committee? Who are the chair and ranking members? What are the interests they're bringing up from the countryside? And it's a huge effort, a huge undertaking, but it's very congressional. USDA typically, in the last couple of farm bills, we saw much more of a advisory role, providing very important background data, economic analysis, legal analysis on provisions and what's working and what challenges they have in the implementation process. So that's a lot more of what USDA is going to get involved with.
Brian, you mentioned environmental regulations, in particular, how much that's been a tough thing for you, particularly in the past couple of years. What has been the hardest thing for you as a farmer, and what would you like to see change?
Well, I think there's a level of uncertainty, and especially as we look at the use of administrative order and regulatory rules that seem to bypass Congress, and then the EPA's Waters of the U.S. rule is just one example of overreach. And so it just creates uncertainty here, and we don't know what we need to do to be in compliance. There's the regulators will tell us one thing, and then it would seem that lawyers would tell us another, and so the uncertainty that comes with any new regulation, I think, has been the hardest thing to deal with. And of course, Waters of the U.S. has been held up in courts trying to determine if it's even constitutional, and so. Yeah, I think that's just a huge challenge. And then pesticides, things that we use, crop production products that we see more getting more and more difficult for us to obtain, less options being on the table for us to use. Those are issues for us.
Mm-hmm. I wonder, as we talk about, one thing we haven't talked about is immigration. And I wonder, Brian or Paul, if either of one of you, Paul, do you have a sense of how new immigration policies might affect agriculture? Is that an issue that's important to you, Paul?
Well, it's not a direct impact, but it is an indirect impact. And what I mean by that is our agriculture is typically quite mechanized. However, when we get into some of my neighbors that do organic things, they need help in the fields, and the folks that do seed corn and some other things that have high labor needs in the fields, I think this immigration issue becomes more and more important. As you get into the livestock sector, particularly dairy, some other states, California, vegetable production, especially the hand-picked stuff, I think it's really critical. I think the situation is almost strained to the breaking point now. And so I think what may happen in the next year or two is going to be really critical for that part of agriculture.
Brian, I know you work with livestock. You have hogs. Do you have an opinion on what needs to happen with our immigration system?
We need a reliable, dependable way to have immigrant labor. I mean, the livestock industry is completely dependent on it, not just on the production standpoint, but on the processing standpoint. I mean, we've got new packing plants on the hog industry going in. Two of them will be going in Iowa in the next 2 years. One's going in Michigan. And we need labor to work in those packing plants. And we need a dependable again, we need certainty in this area as well. We can't staff a packing plant and then worry in 30 days half the workforce is going to be deported. That's not how you can run business. So We have become reliant on immigrant labor, legal immigrant labor, and we need to be certain there's a pathway for that continues going forward.
Brian, do you have any sense of certainty? Do you think that will be accomplished in these next 4 years?
Boy, I don't know. We'll see. Like I said, this is kind of a wait and see. I hope so. So we wait and we see and we express our concerns on these issues to the powers that be.
We are talking with Brian Duncan and Paul Taylor. They're two farmers. Jonathan Coppice is in studio with us as well. When we come back, we are going to continue this conversation about agriculture. We're going to shift it to trade as well. And we've been asking you, by the way, what you would like to see accomplished in the first 100 days. You can join our conversation on social media. You can tweet to 21STShow. You can give us a call, 1-800-222-9455. So far, we've been asking, what do you think is going to happen in the first 100 days? We've had everything from defund Planned Parenthood to people suggesting that President Trump should resign. We'd love to hear from you. You can leave us a voicemail as well. Anyway, give us a call. Sorry, 1-800-222-9455. We're going to continue this conversation, in particular, talking about trade in the next couple of minutes. President Trump, in the past hour, has just signed an executive order saying that he will be withdrawing from the Trans-Pacific Partnership. We're going to be talking about that coming up. Stay tuned. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about how agriculture and farmers and others in the industry might be affected by the new Trump administration. We've just seen in the past hour, President Trump has signed executive orders withdrawing the U.S. from the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal. That's one of his first statements he's been making during the campaign that he was going to be doing. He's also talked about NAFTA. Any changes to trade policy will have a potentially huge impact on our state's economy, Illinois being the fifth largest exporter in the country, much of that agriculture. My guests right now, we're speaking with farmers Brian Duncan and Paul Taylor. In studio with me, Jonathan Coppice is a former federal agricultural policy expert. Before we get into trade, Jonathan, I just want to ask you one more question about the farm bill.
Sure.
Something that Brian and Paul brought up before the break, something that's set to be renegotiated technically next year. Obviously, work will start on this year. We've heard a lot of conversation from Republicans about cutting the budget. What does that mean for the farm bill? What kind of impact do you think that will have?
Yeah, I think that's probably one of the biggest questions for the next farm bill, even before we get into policy specifics. And it's largely due to what we saw in the last farm bill, that it took 3 years and it all kicked off over budget cutting or spending cuts. And we saw the super committee that led into the attempts to try to find $23 billion in reductions in farm spending. And so over the weekend, there's been a lot of news sort of that the administration is looking at pretty tight budget numbers or trying to find ways to cut spending and reduce programs. And so that kind of conversation typically pulls in farm programs and crop insurance and those sort of things, which if so would make writing a farm bill very difficult again and obviously have some real impact on what those programs look like.
And can you give us examples of what the farm bill typically covers? You mentioned crop insurance. It's normally a huge bill that covers lots of different issues.
It's a big bill with a very wide topic base. So the main things that everybody thinks about, and particularly when we talk about cutting spending, there are about four main buckets of spending in a farm bill that are mandatory dollars, mandatory programs that go out without appropriations. That's the farm programs, the commodity programs. The conservation programs are the second one, crop insurance being the third. And then the largest item is the Supplemental Nutritional Assistance Program, used to be food stamps, which goes to low-income families to help purchase food. And so last farm bill, anybody that recalls that effort.
It was a heated debate.
It was a very difficult debate. It actually resulted in the House of Representatives voting down the farm bill in 2013 over a dispute about SNAP. And so you know, my sort of, and this is, you know, probably haven't been too close to it a few times, that to hear those conversations starting again about cutting spending, cutting programs, it brings back a lot of that thinking about, wow, where's the farm bill and where are these programs going to fit? And how does that play out in the politics when we start seeing this sort of back and forth that gets difficult in the writing process?
That's Jonathan Kappas, now at the University of Illinois. Jonathan, thanks. Thanks for being here. Brian Duncan, Paul Taylor, we started this conversation talking about trade, and I didn't get your reaction. Brian, I wonder if I could start with you to President Trump saying now that we are going to be withdrawing from the Trans-Pacific Partnership. I should point out to everybody, this isn't something that was ever ratified, but he's now officially said we will be withdrawing from this. Brian, your thoughts on that?
I guess my question is why? Why would we withdraw at this point? Why not use it as a tool to negotiate? And I know there are some provisions in TPP that do change and affect NAFTA, and as far as some of the, I believe my understanding would be some of the intellectual property rights, and there's some things like that that are addressed in TPP. And I think if you dovetail this with the farm bill, I'm really concerned. Because it could be a 1-2 punch for agriculture. The way to increase prices is to improve and give us better market access. And if we don't increase prices, then that increases our need for a substantial farm bill. And so we're looking at probably negotiating a farm bill with fewer dollars. And if the current trade rhetoric continues, fewer markets for our goods, which would result in lower prices. Something's got to give in that scenario, and I'm not sure what. So I guess my radar goes off a little bit, and I'm willing to wait and see, because maybe President Trump's got something better up his sleeve. But I'd like to know some specifics on why withdraw at this time from TPP. Why not stay in and try to negotiate, use it as a vehicle to negotiate better terms?
Let's bring someone in to help explain a little bit more about this. Phil Levy is a trade economist. He served in the Bush administration from 2003 to 2006. He's now a senior fellow with the Chicago Council on Global Affairs and on the line from Chicago. Hey, Phil, welcome back to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Good to be here.
So probably not a surprise to you, the news that we just saw about President Trump withdrawing from the TPP. Can you help us understand, first of all, it's a trade pact. We've signed it, but we've not ratified it. What else do we need to know about the Trans-Pacific Partnership?
Oh, well, I think, you know, Brian hit it on the head. The real question is why. What we've heard from the Trump administration has rarely been any sort of specific critique, and we can talk about what's in the TPP. But it's more of a general condemnation that it's bad, need to do better, but we don't really have the specifics. In terms of what the TPP did and what was intended to do, it was to standardize rules, make things easier for business, to modernize things like NAFTA, taking into account things like electronic commerce, which wasn't there when some of the reining agreements were put in place, and especially to get new market access for America's farmers, in particular, in places like Japan, which has been notoriously hard to penetrate.
We've also heard, and I wanted to ask you about this, Phil, as well, we've also heard about NAFTA, you know, President Trump saying he's committed to renegotiating NAFTA. What more do we know about that, and what kind of impact could that have on Illinois farmers?
It can have a big impact on Illinois, but we don't really have details. He has said it's a terrible deal. He has been quite explicit about wanting to renegotiate it. In his statements about wanting to renegotiate it, the new president then said, but Mexico's president is terrific and we're going to work on this together. Again, we don't really have any specifics about what he was complaining about and what he, therefore, not much guide to what we would see in a revision. It is clear that there's some real potential dangers at work ahead. He's talked about if anybody produces autos in Mexico, for example, they'll face a high tariff. That runs directly counter to what we agreed in NAFTA. And you're quite right to focus on the effect on Illinois' farmers, but remember, Illinois does a lot of manufacturing exports as well, and if we start messing up supply chains, that will have a very serious impact.
Can we talk about supply chains for a minute? Because when we're thinking particular, I'm thinking about the TPP. I know that About 54% of Illinois' goods exports went to TPP countries in 2015. A lot of this has to do, you know, we've heard talk under the Trump administration also about reducing trade deficits. And I should feel like I should say having a trade deficit isn't something many economists think is a bad thing. But this is something you've written a lot about, Phil. Can you just talk about sort of what we've seen with the Trump administration and discussions about trade deficits and why that might be why that might have an impact now on the economy?
Oh, sure. I think you've hit on two of the things which are hardest for people to get when they don't really focus on trade all the time, both supply chains and trade deficits. With supply chains, I think a lot of people have in mind an image where you either make a car in the United States or you make it in Mexico. In reality, what we see is that cars and a lot of, you know, Boeing airplanes, these are made all over the place. Parts are made in one place, shipped to another, shipped back again. There's been some very good research recently which says if you look at America's top importers, almost all of them are exporters as well. So it's, you really don't want to be thinking about somebody imports and somebody else exports. If you hit the importers, you're hitting the exporters too. On trade deficits, the reason economists caution on this is it's the flip side of borrowing and lending. That may not seem obvious. People like to think of it as a scorecard, that if you export more, you win, and if you import more, you lose. But things have to add up on the global stage. So if the rest of the world wants to invest in the U.S. on net, we're going to run a trade deficit globally. So is it a good idea to borrow from the rest of the world? You know, that's really the same question as, is it a good idea to borrow in general? Sometimes, if you're going to get an education, start a business, do something productive, yeah, it could be a good idea to borrow. If you're going to throw a wild party, maybe not. So that's why, in and of themselves, trade deficits aren't a very good measure. And that's even talking with the whole world. They mean even less when you talk about with a country like China. And it exactly has to do with that supply chain argument, because goods get shipped all around, but we only count them when they come out of the final country that does the finishing work. And it means that those statistics really aren't worth very much.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Phil Levy. He's a senior fellow with the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. Brian, Paul, I just want to ask you guys, I mean, you guys are people who are paying attention to this. You're paying attention to trade deficits. You're paying close attention to trade policy because this affects your business and your livelihood every day. I just want to ask both of you one last question about what you'd like to see with trade policy. Brian, it sounds like you were a little concerned. Let's start with you. What would you like President Trump to do in terms of our trade agreements?
More trade. I think I would like people to understand that trade isn't a zero-sum game. We win, they lose. They win, we lose. I don't see it that way. I'd like our president, and I'd like people to understand that trade has a potential to elevate everybody. It's not a zero-sum game. Yes, there may be some job losses here, but they are usually, in my understanding, as I look at the economics of it, there are jobs created as well. I don't think we can shut the doors to the rest of the world. I think trade has gone a long way to improving freedom and living standards, not just here, but all over the globe, which makes us all ultimately, I think, safer. So I would like the president to understand trade is crucial, not just to my business, but to our economy and, I think, world peace.
Paul, what do you think in terms of you and your farm in particular, but also what you want people to know about farmers across Illinois and trade policy?
Well, I think when you think of what Jonathan and Phil have talked about in Brian, trade is an important part of farm profitability. Farm profitability is what drives most of us, what drives our interest in farm organizations. And so as a consequence, we know that trade's important. I think where we're going and what we need a couple things, particularly besides the agreements. I think we need to follow up on this whole business of infrastructure, roads and bridges locally, lock and dams are a big problem on the Mississippi. These things are getting out to 80 years old. They were never intended to be that long. Think of it as a pipe to export our goods, particular grains. We've got the river system to get it there, and then we've got the whole issue of what we can do to get it on ships. Panama Canal has been expanded. We've already seen some things going on with Brazil and Argentina that we ship soybeans from our fall till late winter. they ship soybeans the rest of the time, then we ship corn after that. I mean, it gets complicated. The other side, the other item, is this whole issue of where we're going to go with improving our genetics of our crop protection products, of our seeds, of our animals. Are we going to get standardization? Are we going to be able to trade with the EU at some point? Are we going to be able to trade with China? There's good agreement within the North and South American partners how to handle this. When you go east and west around the globe, there's some issues. We've got to get this GMO thing. What are we going to do with CRISPR, et cetera? So as we transition from environmental policies being the thing to fiscal and trade issues, I think we have to keep that in mind. And as President Trump, when you think about it, and you look at the map of red and blue states, and you can drive from Miami to Missoula and not go through a red state, there's a lot of territory there. There's a lot of expectations. It's going to be a lot for a dysfunctional Washington, Congress, the administration, to deliver before the 2018 elections.
Thanks to Paul Taylor, who's joining us from DeKalb, Brian Duncan as well, from Ogle County, from Polo, Illinois. Gentlemen, thanks for being with me.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. A pleasure. Thank you.
Phil, let me ask you one last question as we've been talking about this. You know, as we've been hearing these farmers talk about how trade policy is important to them, whether it's not just how they do their businesses. We were just hearing Paul talk about seed, lots of other really complex things that are affecting all different parts of the economy. I just wanted to ask you about what you heard from President Trump in his inauguration address about the role that he sees for the U.S. playing in the global economy moving forward. What did you interpret what he said? I'm thinking in particular of his America First comments he made on Friday. What do you think this means for the U.S.'s role in the economy moving forward?
It's hard to know what that means. It's the critical question. But the phrase itself, America First, of course, harkens back to an isolationist theme that came out in the 1930s in the U.S. I don't know whether that's what he intends. I think, as your guests described very, very well, we are critically dependent on trade. We've prospered with trade. And so if you really want to look out for America's interests, it's going to involve bolstering, not tearing down, the global trading system. I hope the new president perceives that.
Do you have a sense that, I mean, President Trump seems to be saying that he's going to leverage trade policy to bring more investment into the U.S., to prevent more companies from outsourcing. Do you think this could backfire? It sounds a little bit like what you're saying.
Oh, it certainly could backfire. I think we can see two things happen. One, if you say that you're going to hit anybody who tries to sort of invest abroad and bring stuff back in, you invite retaliation because it violates agreements we've made in the past. And we know that that kind of retaliation often goes after things like U.S. agriculture. So it can definitely hit us that way. And as we discussed before, when you've got global supply chains throwing wrenches in those processes, that can also hurt us. Illinois, the rest of the country, we're all very dependent on that as part of the modern economy.
Phil Levy is a senior fellow with the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. He also teaches at Northwestern University's Kellogg School of Business. If you're interested more in trade deficits and other things Phil has been writing about, we've been tweeting out some links. He's got a blog post, Everything You Ever Wanted to Know About Trade Deficits, so you can read that. Phil, thanks for being with me.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up, as I said, all this week we're going to be talking about the new Trump administration, its effect on Illinois' economy. Tomorrow we are going to be looking more at manufacturing. And we have a question for you. What would you like to see in these first 100 days of the Trump administration? You can tweet us, 21STShow. You can send us an email, talk@21STShow, or you can give us a call, 1-800-222-9455. Stay tuned. Coming up, Amanda Vinicky is going to be joining us for a preview of all the action that's expected to happen in Springfield this week. So we're going from Washington to Springfield. Springfield next. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Are we getting closer to a budget for the state of Illinois? This week in Springfield, several committee meetings are scheduled for the Senate. They'll be discussing different aspects of this so-called grand bargain. That's roughly a dozen different bills that have been put forward by Senate President John Cullerton and Senate Republican leader Christine Redonio. As you know, we really haven't had a budget for about 2 years in the state of Illinois. We've got Governor Rauner on Wednesday expected to deliver his State of the State address to tell us all about what's ahead for the week in State House. Amanda Vinicky is with us, former Illinois Public Radio State House Bureau Chief. She's now a reporter with WTTW's Chicago Tonight. Hey, Amanda, welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks for having me, Nyla.
So Senate hearing scheduled for this week. Is this the week our state gets a budget?
Well, I don't think I would go that far because, of course, even though, let's say it were to get through all of those committees and pass the Senate, because and you may think that could happen, given that obviously the Senate president and top Republican leader in that chamber have signed on. That is not to say that we have heard the same from the House, and we're not clear exactly where Governor Bruce Rauner stands on things. He has gone out of his way to say that he wasn't and hasn't been involved in negotiations, nor has his office. And while he said that he was optimistic about it, he also, threw some cold water on the deal by his office kind of leaking basically a memo that showed, as at least it was originally presented, and we're hearing that there may be some changes, but at least it was originally presented, this Senate, quote, grand compromise would leave the state budget short. Still.
Right. Let's talk about what's in. Yeah. What's in the grand compromise then? What are we, because we've seen for to catch everybody up over the weekend, we've heard about a new tax on sugary drinks, proposed income tax increases. That's part of the revenue side of this. What else are we seeing?
So, right. Yeah. As you noted, there remains to be seen. There is supposed to be this tax on sugary beverages, whether or not that'll be a part of the deal. I think that is one of the elements that is in negotiation. Clearly, there is going to be some component of new revenue right now, or at least again, originally that was at 4.95%. So you're under what it had been when Governor Pat Quinn was around, but there are mumblings that it could instead be higher perhaps than it or that 5% threshold. Again, at some point there's going to be the assumption is this your income taxes are going to go up, but it does more than that. It basically doubles the number of casinos that Illinois has, and so you have a major gaming component. That's controversial. Changes to workers' compensation. One element of the plan that isn't actually in legislative form, but you saw action in the Senate, is term limits. This there is a plan to make that more prolonged, but already you have had right away, as soon as they were inaugurated, the Senate leadership, Cullerton, Redonio, limit themselves to a 10-year term. And again, I think that's worthy of pointing out, not because it's one of these bills that we're going to be hearing about this week, but because it shows that this is more than just talk, that that was acted on, that you actually had the bills assigned to committee and they're trying to get them through as soon as possible. That is significant twofold. Number one, even though there is and certainly has already been some pushback, you don't have a huge opportunity for opposition to galvanize when it is hurried through. But further, again, it's just a demonstration that this isn't just a plan that it was thrown out there and drafted with bullet points, something that we have seen before, well, through these couple of years that Illinois has been without a true budget. But it is so much more than that.
Right. So our stopgap funding, to remind everyone, ran out on December 31st. Social service agencies, publicly funded universities, some correctional institutions no longer receiving payments. Are there any temporary measures being considered? Another stopgap? Any conversations about that, Amanda?
Not that we've actually seen introduced. That was something that seemed to be from the House Speaker Michael Madigan, and his spokesperson are rarely very direct in announcing their plans, but indications were that that is the preferred mode by the Speaker. Therefore, that is something that I think there may be a call for. But right now, truly, this is soaking up a lot of the attention. And what you have heard Senate President Cullerton say is that, no, we won't need a stopgap if, in fact, this passes. This is an all-encompassing budget for this year and for next year. That is obviously quick action. What it does is would finally guarantee universities and these social services that are yet again not only hurting because they are without funding since the start of this year, that's just a couple of weeks, but clearly they went without funding for really all pretty much of the last fiscal year. And so then they never got the full amount of money that they had been expecting. So they're really kind of operating on empty and starting from a disadvantage. But right now there has not been any true attention for a stopgap budget. And therefore, if this all dies and all falls flat, yeah, you have a whole lot more uncertainty and hardship facing those entities whose funding ran out at the end of 2016.
Last quick question for you, Amanda. Wednesday, State of the State. Do we expect Governor Rauner to essentially deliver the same couple speeches? I mean, we really haven't heard any different language from him. It's been almost verbatim the same things he's been saying for the past couple of years. Do you think Wednesday will be any different?
You know, Nyla, you're right. It's like you could pull a string and guess which of the terms the governor would say when he opens his mouth. I presume we will hear, yes, some more of that. He clearly believes that those phrases, either believes in them or believes that they help the public to understand what he is aiming to achieve, or perhaps both. But I don't know how at this point he could give a State of the State address without giving some nod to what the Senate is expected to be spending the large part of the day taking up with this potential grand compromise. He'll talk a lot about what he perceives to be achievements throughout this granted tumultuous term, perhaps a bit of an indication in terms of what else he wants to do, not so much with the budget. He'll save that for later, but I'd look for him to introduce a plan, something that perhaps is significant, and talking about a couple of wins, looking back at, for example, that compromise with lead testing in schools. That's something I think that the public generally appreciates and likes the sound of, shows that even despite the budget impasse, he believes he is governing and has some big wins.
WTTW's Amanda Vinicky on her way to Springfield for that Wednesday address, which, of course, we'll be carrying live. Amanda, great to talk to you. Thanks.
It was great talking to you again. Thank you, Nyla.
A little bouncer slowly toward Bryant. He will glove it and throw to Rizzo. It's in time. And the Chicago Cubs win the World Series. The Cubs come pouring out of the dugout, jumping up and down like a bunch of delirious 10-year-olds. The Cubs have done it.
I bet you remember exactly where you were if you were watching the Chicago Cubs win the World Series this past November. Next season, Chicago baseball fans will be able to watch all the big Cubs and White Sox moments on the go wherever or anywhere they want. We're joined now by sports business reporter Danny Ecker from Crane Chicago Business to talk about the Chicago Cubs and White Sox new deal with the television network CSN Chicago to stream games anywhere. Hey, Danny, welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks for having me.
So what are the details of this new deal? This is with CSN?
Yeah, so essentially we're talking about a partnership between CSN's parent company, which is NBC, Universal, and Major League Baseball. So this actually goes for all the Comcast Sportsnet regional networks that cover baseball, which there's one in Philadelphia, then there's CSN Chicago, and there's one in the Bay Area. Essentially what this is what's called authenticated streaming. So it's basically kind of the TV everywhere model where they say, all right, if you get CSN Chicago here and you're used to watching the Cubs and Sox games on your TV, we want to let you be able to do that anywhere on your mobile device, on your phone, on a computer, online, wherever you are, as long as you can prove to us that you are a subscriber. So this is not like live streaming for anybody and you don't have to watch on TV or subscribe to cable anymore. The whole idea is Comcast Sportsnet, which, by the way, is co-owned by the Cubs and the Sox, along with NBC Universal, as well as the Blackhawks and the Bulls, their idea is they want to make sure that they can serve up that TV everywhere concept. And so this is a deal that more regional networks like CSN are doing now with leagues, striking these deals to make sure that they can meet the needs and the demands, really, of fans to be able to watch their teams wherever they are.
And so to prove a subscription, do you need a login and password? Is this going to be kind of like an HBO Go situation where everybody is sharing passwords all over?
Exactly. And that's exactly how it's going to work. You know, actually CSN already does this for the Chicago Bulls games they air, and also for the Blackhawks. They started that this year as well, so they had to do those separate deals with the NHL and the NBA respectively. And it's really simple. You know, you have this NBC Sports app, or you can actually go on their site, csnchicago.com, and it just asks you for your cable, username and password, which you have to obviously set up through your cable provider, satellite provider, if you have that set up. But it's a pretty easy process, and, you know, it's the product, I think, has been pretty good so far, and, it's just a matter of, being able it's just kind of one of those things that fans really – In 2016, 2017 now are sort of demanding that you have to be able to do this.
And just to be clear, Danny, so it has to be a cable network that has CSN Chicago. Is that only available in the Chicagoland area, or is that broadcast through other parts of Illinois?
CSN Chicago is broadcast outside of Chicago. It's pretty much all of Illinois, and you've got a little bit into Iowa, a little bit into Wisconsin, a little bit into Indiana. There are, some pockets as you kind of go out to those areas that don't get it. But it's a pretty broad reach, and that's what makes it such a big deal. And then to your point earlier, Nyla, about password sharing and things like that, which obviously happens when it comes to Netflix, HBO Go, other things like other subscription models like that. That's something that is certainly a concern. I think it's going to make it a little bit hard to police, especially for the Cubs, where you have Cubs fans nationwide. And if they've got a friend, for example, who lives in Chicago, maybe doesn't necessarily log in, maybe they like to use their they kind of like to watch on TV and they don't log in anyway, there's nothing stopping them really from using their password to log in, unless the technology can be built as such that it prevents you from being able to do this on a certain phone other than your own. But I mean, I think they're far from that point. So if you're a Cubs fan living in Arizona, previously your only options for streaming Cubs games would be MLB.tv, which is a subscription service where you could pay to live stream Cubs and Sox games. Now, at least for the games that air on CSN Chicago, which is not all of them, but it's the majority of them, you can actually, if you wanted to borrow a friend's password at this point, you'll be able to do that this season and watch those games, live stream those games for free.
Will it include playoff games too? How funny is it that we can talk about playoff games, by the way, with the Cubs now?
It won't unless they're on CSN Chicago. So in Major League Baseball's case, it's all these things are on Fox or on
Right, and I know the MLB has been so strict with this. But let me ask you, are the Cubs using this in any way to predict how well they're going to be doing? I know you and I have talked about the Cubs launching their own network once their TV deals expire in 2019.
It's definitely going to be a great metric for them. I think, they're right in the middle of these negotiations right now and talks about what their plans are going to be when their deal with CSN expires at the end of 2019. And being able to look at live streaming numbers and how much people are really kind of adopting that and really using the live stream as opposed to watching on linear television, it's going to be helpful. Ultimately, that's kind of a separate discussion in terms of being able to figure out what they want to do. They want to launch their own channel, and does that channel have its own live streaming, ability associated with it? They have a lot of different options in front of them, but this is certainly a really helpful metric for them to be able to look at and say, all right, we know how many people are, at least are interested in live streaming our product as opposed to watching just on TV.
Danny, one last quick question for you. How much money does this make for the teams, for the Sox and for the Cubs? How important is it? You mentioned they own a share of CSN Chicago. Is this a big part of making money for the teams?
At this point, live streaming is not. I mean, you have to look at it from two perspectives. One, remember that CSN and thereby the teams are actually paying Major League Baseball for the right to live stream this. So, in the case of the Fox Regional Networks, which had a deal this past season with MLB, they were paying reportedly $2 million per year per team for the rights. You're basically paying for the live streaming rights because MLB has those rights and they need to be able to give up some of that. It's kind of an investment, really, by the teams to be able to say, look, our fans want to be able to watch anywhere. We need to be able to serve them that, and we're going to make that investment to do that. Now they can pull in some revenue from it by selling advertisements, things like that. And that's a big deal for them too, but we're still talking small potatoes compared to the TV commercials they sell.
Right. Danny Ecker covers the business of sports for Crane Chicago Business. Thanks, Danny.
Thanks for having me.
That does it for us today. Tomorrow we'll continue our discussion on the impact the Trump administration is expected to have on the Illinois economy with a look at manufacturing. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.